Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything.
Get the right home policy at the right price.
With the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company S.I. and its operating company 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show. All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of The Smiley Show. Got the most recent PGA Tour winner joining us today. This is Maverick McNealy. Maverick, as it stands, we're middle of December. It's been not quite a month since your first PGA Tour win, but I imagine it's been a lot of fun celebrating with friends and family over the last three or so weeks. How has it been?
Yeah, it's been awesome. You never really know when it's going to happen, if it's going to happen. And it definitely made the offseason a lot crazier, more fun, and a week shorter too, which I'm not upset about. But things have been moving pretty quick.
What you been up to?
Did a lot. So we came home on Monday, missed our flight Sunday night. We were flying out of Jacksonville, and you know, that putt went in. Yeah, we weren't going to make that flight.
That's the time you actually were excited about missing a flight.
Oh, it's great. I mean, it was the best. We were staying in a cottage right off the putting green all week, and it turns out that was the cottage that they give to the winner, because the winner always stays the night over after all the media stuff. So
makes it
we
easy.
Didn't even know it. We were staying in the winner's cottage all week.
Well, that makes it easy. After that, you've had opportunities to maybe go watch a buddy go play some Q school, and a year later, just celebrated, I guess, with family, your wedding.
Yeah. It's been a big couple weeks. So we win, come home for Thanksgiving. We're driving down to La Quinta, and just kind of a freak accident, get rear-ended. We're all fine, but car's totaled. So spent 3.5 hours in the middle of the desert at night. Oh, that was fun.
Gosh.
And then, celebrate with the family over Thanksgiving. That was great. Come back home, and then we're right back there for kind of our 1 year anniversary celebration. We eloped, Maya and I eloped a year ago with just our parents there, and kind of planned the party for a year later. So we had that, which was a great time. And then quick honeymoon in Hawaii, which
Where'd
I guess
you go?
They would be giving us, we went to Lanai for 5 days. It was amazing.
Wow.
So they're going to be giving us Hawaii residents here pretty soon.
You're going back soon now.
Yeah. So,
and you, just, will you play both? You'll play Century and Sony.
Yeah, I'm going to play both of those. Play 7 out of the first 8 to start the year. Because, hey, I'm wife's traveling with me. I don't have kids yet. And what else am I going to do?
Yeah. Well, it's a good problem to have, because you got those two extra signature events for finishing inside the Aon Next 10. Yeah. See, I'm still in TV mode. I still, like, remember all the things I need to say for the broadcast. But, a lot to be excited for if you're Maverick McNealy. But let's quickly kind of go through the RSM Classic, as for those of you that had a chance to watch Maverick get it done. I don't think anybody really knew who was going to get it done, because it was such a close race on that back nine. You know, you had Luke Clanton involved, you had Nico Echeverria involved, and then there was somebody playing with you that I'm trying to remember. It was a 4-horse race, and there was somebody else. Yeah. Who the heck was it?
I was in a group with Vince Whaley and Daniel Berger.
Berger, that's who it was. I was like, there's somebody else too. I couldn't remember who it was. Everybody had their own unique story. You had Vince, yourself, and Berger all having, you know, major medical injuries. And you got Nico Echeverria, who had probably the best fall outside of maybe you. And then Luke Clanton, and his season was insane. So it was so many storylines, and really a compelling RSM Classic.
Yeah, it's different watching on the broadcast versus being in the final group, because I really don't know what's going on in the groups up ahead of me, other than just seeing the scoreboard updates. And we were really cruising along, and then things started to get a little wonky on the back nine. Ball started going really far. Had a few, you know, the wind was tricky. It kind of switched around and played differently by the end of the day than it was supposed to. And then just bogeyed. Made fives on 14 and 15, which were not good. And all of a sudden it was, and the putt slides by on 16. And I was thinking I had to birdie 17 and 18 to have a chance. And then we get to the 17th green and I look at the leaderboard and all of a sudden we're back tied for the lead again. I didn't see those guys making bogey on 18, but I mean, it was playing hard. I hit pitching wedge on Saturday to a soft pitching wedge and hit full six iron on Sunday and figured it's like, well, if no one else wants it, I might as well try and take it. So it's like, I was just shocked that I had a chance, and it came down to like, if I hit two good shots, I could win this thing on 18, and just was grateful for the opportunity at that point.
Yeah. So you hit that beautiful six iron into a left pin off of a slight downslope back in the breeze, like you talk about. And, you know, Daniel Berger misses his putt, and all of a sudden, you know, your mind is able to go there for that 4-footer that you had. That was kind of, I thought, a tricky read because the hole is slanting this way. Mm-hmm. Almost felt like the ball could, you know, inch a little bit to the right at the beginning. That type of weird putt. But you know, your mind, I imagine, is like, man, this is what I've been working towards my entire golfing career, and I'm sure you dreamt about it. But when you're in that, you know, 45 second routine, were you able to run your routine and not get ahead of yourself about the putt? Or the whole time were you like, oh my gosh, this is the time, just please hit the center of the face and get this thing started online?
That's the weird thing. Like, to me, looking back on that day, the craziest thing was how time warped throughout the day. So the first 11 holes, I swear, felt like it took 6 hours. Like, I was like, this round is never going to end. I've got a 2-shot lead. Like, man, this is the longest day I've ever been on the golf course. And then started hitting it in some bad spots, you know, had to make par on 11, made a par putt from the back fringe, had a double bunker par save on 13, kind of made a mess of 14, and felt like things were speeding up a little bit. Like, like just kind of, you know, spiraling downhill a little bit. And then I get to 17 and all of a sudden, I hit a really good putt, just catches the edge. And that was actually a putt to take the lead back. And
it was such a good putt too.
And I mean, yeah, it's just tricky putting out there when the greens get that fast. But the weird thing was, from when I hit the tee shot on 18 to when I was standing over my putt to win, it felt like 30 seconds. And I was like, I couldn't believe, I just remember having this kind of out of body experience where I was like, wow, this is a putt to win. And then before I knew it, the putt was a foot off the putter face and I just knew it was dead center. And it went through my head. I was like, holy crap, I just won.
How do you explain that? Like, how do you explain how our brain works when it comes to, you know, thinking about winning the entire day and just trying to get to the finish line versus when you're, have the opportunity to be there, we're able to enter this, you know, flow state of focus that you can't explain to people.
So I'm curious how it felt on your first win, but like, for me, I think it all comes down to routine. Like, so I hit that six iron, you know, Scout just left me with one thought. He was like, just compress it. That's just what I've been working on. Compress it. Feel like I hit down, came off perfectly. It's a 200 yard six iron that flew 184 back into this cold wheat breeze. And Scott was like, yeah, the moment I saw that thing start at the left edge and just start to fall right on the wind, he was like, yep, that's it. And, but then I was just, you know, spent the whole time trying to just calm my breathing down, slow my thinking down. And before I knew it, it was my turn to putt. There was one putt left in the tournament. And like, for me, I think it comes down to routine because it's just a routine I've done hundreds of thousands of times. And like, once you start the routine, it's kind of like jumping off a high dive. Like, jumping's not hard and starting your routine's not hard. But once you start it, like, you're going to hit the water and you're going to hit the putt. So like, I just started my routine and then, you know, whatever, 20 seconds later, the putt was off the putter face. And then that's when you kind of like lock back, you're zoned back in. You're like, oh my gosh, that's dead center. I just won.
It's wild. I've unfortunately wasn't able to get in that zone enough, but when I did get in that zone, I had some really nice moments on the tour. And it makes me think a little bit about Scottie Scheffler, Xander Schauffele, but really I would probably say those two guys, because I think mentally they're probably the best in the world compared to, you know, we watched Tiger Woods grow up and we knew he had the edge over everybody physically and mentally. But now when I watch Scottie and Xander, what what strikes me, and I'm curious of your opinion of this, is how it seems like every shot is the most important shot, and they're able to stay in a one shot at a time mentality, when I would say that 99% of the tour, you know, is able to find that maybe once a year at one tournament where they go on to win. It could be every 3 years, but they seem to do it every week. And I it just blows me away of that type of mental endurance to be able to pull that off. Are you able to kind of add some insight to what you've seen maybe from those two guys on that?
Yeah, I'm going to quote Scotty Hamm. And if you know him, you know, it comes out in a much thicker country accent, but he's like, man, it's pretty easy to have a good attitude when it's coming out of the joint. Like, if you know that ball is going to go where you're aiming, it gets really fun and really exciting and gives you a lot of confidence, gets you really excited. Like, when you're worried about that, it's a lot harder to stay present. It's a lot harder to have that confidence that, you know, even if stuff doesn't go the right way now, I'm playing good enough, I'm hitting it good enough, and that I'll get it going the right way. It's just, I think it's a lot less stressful. Like,
that's interesting. You know, yeah. Like, you make a good point there, because, you know, I think any pro golfer, when they get stressed, it's because they don't know where the golf ball is going. They don't know how to make the adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I just, you know, I think when you've got something that you really believe in and really trust, and like, it took me a while to get that. And then it's just that trust built this fall, and it kind of all came together at Sea Island. But
yeah,
I was like, you know, you're stressed. You don't want to make bogeys. You don't want to give up your lead. Like, you want to hit a great shot on 18, but like, it came down to like, if I do these two things in my golf swing, or if I have this one feel, like, it's probably going to come off good. And there's no reason why it wouldn't, because it's come off good for 71 holes. Like, that makes it a lot more fun. And that's when you just take a little tighter line and try and hit a great shot.
Yeah, absolutely. And Scotty Hamilton, a guy that I've taken from, I love him to death. Coming out the joint, this guy's from Cartersville, Georgia. He's the best. Right. And we actually ripped a video from Scott Hamilton's Instagram. This was you working with him, I believe, was it yesterday?
Yesterday.
I think it was yesterday. Yeah. So we're going to get into a little bit of your injury history, but the text I got from Scott Hamilton when asking about you, Maverick, was your shoulder injury. How it kind of happened, your swing got like the face got open and the club got underneath, and now you are trying to work on just hitting a fade. I mean, was that something that you did in collegiate golf and early pro golf? Like, have you always seen fade?
So it was. I can give the kind of 30,000 foot view of my golf swing, and it makes everything kind of make sense. In college, I was very much over the plane. And kind of steep and left. And I would always try and hit draws, and they'd always come out like little fades. I wasn't a great driver of the ball. I think that was partly equipment related. Started working with Butch, and that really turned around my driving, a lot more dynamic move. And that's, you know, what got me onto the PGA Tour there and allowed me to compete.
What do you mean dynamic move? What was the dynamic move you're talking about?
It's just a lot more hip turn, shoulder turn, and a better weight transfer. You know, you look at those early videos of Tiger, that guy rotates a ton, and really just increasing that rotational speed helped me a lot.
So you were hanging back a little bit? Is that what you're kind of saying there?
Staying on my left side a little bit, and more than anything, got ahead of the ball. And when you get ahead of the ball, I had to back up through it. So that kind of happened. Then I got a lot stronger, gained a lot of speed, worked out a bunch. And unfortunately, I started to get really underneath, and that club got really under the plane, stuck behind my hands. And the way I'd shallow from being ahead of the ball and under the plane was to back up out of it harder and jam my left shoulder up and in. And it was 2022 at Pebble. On the, I think it was the seventh tee at Monterey Peninsula, there was like an hour backup, because there's just always a
always
backup
is.
On that tee.
That's a tough par three too. It's like always like a four iron to that back left pin, or maybe front left. It's always on the left side.
It is. And I really wish I hit a four iron, because I sat there waiting for, you know, almost an hour. Like, it's cold, you get tight. And I think I tried to smash a five, because at that point I wasn't, you know, when you're way underneath and flipping the face, it's not comfortable to hit a nice little soft hold off. And
yeah,
so I tried to rip the five. I felt something weird in my shoulder. And then by the 10th hole, it felt like someone was sticking a knife in my chest every time I took a backswing. And I tore the ligament that connects my collarbone to my sternum. Tried to play through it a bunch. Golf is hard, and it's really hard when you're hurt. And I realized that I wasn't doing any favors for myself. At that point, I was 28th in the FedEx Cup, like having a great year.
You had like six top 15s or something. It was almost like you're finally really like trending towards a win. Like, so that had to be so deflating, right?
A little bit. I was number one on tour putting. I was gaining more than a stroke around putting. So I was just making everything I looked at.
You're
really
just hooping.
Yeah, I was just hooping. It wasn't like I was maxing out everything I could out of my golf game, especially when I was hurt. I still see Butch and talk with him a bunch, go hit some with him every once in a while. But I kind of he's the best to do it ever, but he just doesn't travel as much and I don't get to see him as much. And I started spending a bunch of time with Scotty Hamm and got on 3D with him in Cartersville. And he's like, yeah, I mean, the way your left shoulder's working, of course your shoulder's going to hurt. So he really wanted to get this left shoulder working down and around as opposed to up and in. He kind of floated me the idea of hitting cuts. And I was like, all I see is draws now. I've been hitting draws for 6 years and coincidentally not been hitting it very good. But eventually I kind of took my medical, had PRP done, and used that to kind of rework my golf swing, retool my golf swing to get the swing direction from, way right to significantly left. And,
started to come out the joint for you.
It did. Well, not initially, but eventually it did. And, if I talk 6 degrees of swing direction, that's like a mountain in terms of golfers feels like,
yeah.
That's the difference between a 15-yard draw and a 5-yard fade, which is huge. And so that's kind of where we went with it. My brother Scout's been caddying for me the last couple weeks. And in Jackson, he was like, yeah, we get it going really good Monday through Wednesday. But then Thursday through Sunday, we start to see more and more of these kind of push draws, which turn into pushes, which turn into blocks. And he's like, we need to be hitting like steep, scuzzy cuts Monday through Wednesday, so that when you get up on the tee on Thursday,
so
it's coming out falling right.
Right.
So that was another kind of breakthrough. But that's just kind of what we've done. We just move the swing direction left. I'm hitting down on it more. That's what Scotty says when we compress it. Just like, going shallow to steep as opposed to, steep a couple ways and shallow late. When I smack down on that ball and try and take a divot, it tends to come out better.
So Maverick, you and I both were paired together at the U.S. Open in Pinehurst back in 2014. You were a freshman at Stanford. You were crushing it. I had just turned pro. I don't know what's going on. I got my brother Lucky
on the bag.
I got Lucky caddying for me. Your dad Scott was caddying for you. Do you have any memories at all from those 2 days? Because I personally, mine are always that Lucky and I didn't figure out till Wednesday afternoon that the bowl numbers in the book were to the front of the green. That was like one of the things that we learned. And then we played 18 holes Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then by Thursday, we were just toast.
That's amazing. I almost had the same week. I played 18 on Monday and Tuesday, and then only 9 on Wednesday because Cameron Wilson, former teammate of mine, was like, yeah, man,
Cameron,
don't play 18 today. Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember Cam.
Oh, my gosh. God, how he was, man, was he right out of school? Was he freaking playing some good golf?
Gosh, he hit it so good. He taught me so much, too, like all the ball flight laws, TrackMan stuff.
Oh,
he would stand behind me on the range, and I'd be hitting drivers and trying to shape it a certain way, and he'd just go face. Nope. That was path. Toed that one. That was good. Just like,
wow. So he's got an eye for it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I just remember playing. It was you, me, and Brandon MacGyver, who I played a bunch of college golf with. I was like,
at Oregon, right?
Yep. Oregon. Yep. I was like, man, Smiley, he's a pro. Like, he's like a real pro. It was cool.
I didn't know what I was doing. I can tell you that much.
But I think I hit 3 iron off of 10. And I just remember looking down at this like Nike VR Pro 3-iron going, am I going to even hit the club face?
Because we started on 10.
Yeah. I hit 3-iron, like bailed out 45 feet left of a right pin with a pitching wedge and then like the most tentative two putt. But I remember my dad caddying for me and I forget what hole it was. There's some hole on the back nine, but I hit my drive, middle of the fairway. I'm like up there. I get my number. I'm like, okay, it's going to be an 8-iron, middle of the green. Where's dad? And he had been waiting for the portalet to open up. And I'm like standing in the middle of the fairway. I feel like my pants are down around my ankles. Like I'm just waiting for him for like what felt like 15 minutes. It was probably 2 minutes. But I was just standing there like everyone's looking at me. I'm looking around like that's my ball. I don't have any clubs. I don't have my 8-iron, and finally dad comes running up and always laughs that I chew him out for going to the bathroom at the US Open, but I plugged it in the right bunker, chunked it over the green. Nice double. Thanks, dad.
Well, I just remember your dad being so, so nice, but also he was wanting the best for you more so than any dad I've ever watched. Like he was so proud. He got so happy. Like when you had big moments that he wasn't great at hiding him. Like, I don't think he's you do definitely not want your dad caddying for you on tour because he would get way too excited because I think he was every time you had big moments, he was just like, boom, let's go.
there's not a camera he hasn't waved to out there. it's interesting. Like, The family relationships and even, you know, friends and whatnot, having such a public profession,
right.
You know, it's been something I didn't expect to have to manage, but, I kind of wanted to separate. I was like, dad, you know, now I'm a professional. This is my job. I want to do my own thing, you know, kind of don't mess around in my business. Cause I get really upset. He's like, you're not hitting your putts hard enough. I was like, what do you mean you're not hitting your putts hard enough? And so kind of wasn't ideal in terms of, I just would get really, kind of in my head with him out there, which is a complete 180 from having him caddy for me at the US Open. And basically I realized that, you know, the answer wasn't to like try and, you know, separate church and state. It was like actually let him know what I'm doing. Cause he's my biggest fan.
Right.
Same with my dad. Like you said, deal. He wants to the best for me. And like, I found that if I actually told him what I'm doing and what I'm working on and what's going on, like it was just a lot of fun to talk golf with him. So
right.
It's kind of like, I don't think I'm going to have him caddy for me. it's kind of full 360 there. Just, you know, it makes me super happy. He and mom are renting a house down the road from where we are, for Augusta.
Amazing.
And the Masters is going to be a really fun family deal this year. So those are the daddy caddy days are great though.
Well, I'm sure that it's gonna be a fun first experience playing your first Masters. And I want to talk a little just about your dad and how, you know, you're a very successful PGA Tour player. He's a very successful businessman. What did you learn from your dad over the years as far as just, you know, how to run your own business? Or is there anything that he was able to give to you as far as just, you know, creating a work ethic to get you to, you know, where you want to be in life?
I mean, I can't really put a finger on how much I've learned from dad. It's even to the point where if I've got some scenario in my head or some scenario I'm facing, I hear his voice in my head. It's like, I know exactly what my dad would say. I'm sure a lot of people are like that, but just from a life standpoint, his work ethic was unbelievable. He stepped down as CEO when I was 11 so he could spend more time with us. But I remember wanting to go shoot hockey pucks in the back. And I was like, dad, you want to come shoot pucks with me? It's like, I'll be out there in a little bit, but that's my stack of reading. And it was just a milk carton with that much paper. And then he was doing email. That guy had a sense of duty where he's like, all my employees and all my shareholders are relying on me and I can't let them down. One of the coolest things is when I'm on the road and just random people will come up and say, hey, I worked for your father back in the day. I worked for Sun.
Oh, that's cool.
It's the best job I ever had. Like, it was the most fun I ever had. and you know, some of my sponsors like Cisco, do some stuff with AWS. Like there's a lot of people in the tech world, and that's a really cool crossover. The thing I appreciate about my dad is he's always told me that if there's a, you can even see the bright red line between what's right and what's wrong, just turn around and run. And always doing stuff the right way. You know, I think in a sport like golf, it drives me nuts when guys take a drop on the wrong side of that literal red line.
Yeah.
Like, did it really cross there? Because I know that I will never drop beyond where I am certain I at least covered. Like, that's just stuff like that. But then running a business, like I do year-end reviews with my whole team every year just to figure out how we can work better, how I can make them, you know, better at their job, enjoy their job more. And you know, golfers do run a little business. We've got,
nobody prepares you for it either.
Mm-mm.
Nobody prepares you to fire somebody that's much older than you.
No, that's the worst part of the job for sure.
Yeah.
But you know, he helped me with the interview process, you know, finding sponsors, finding, my team, and I'm really fortunate to have an incredible team around me. I mean, it sounds so cliche, but like it really does take a village to, you know, have a professional golfer compete. You can't do this all on your own.
No, you definitely can't. And I'm interested in the balance you talked about when you mentioned how your dad would have a stack of reading, while you're, you know, wanting to go, you know, shoot hockey pucks, which I didn't know was that a first passion of yours before golf, by the way?
Oh yeah. All me and my three brothers, we all played more hockey than golf growing up. And
okay. Let's dive into that. So when did golf become like, oh wait, I think I'll be better at this in hockey.
It was probably the first time I went up and played hockey in Canada. And I realized that the 220-pound 16-year-olds could actually skate, and
okay,
probably wouldn't be it for me.
It sounds like me as a point guard. I realized I wasn't quite catching rim when I would try to jump, so I probably wasn't going to make it.
it's tough. You know, and I also didn't want to leave home in my sophomore year of high school and go play on the East Coast. My brother Dakota was probably the best hockey player out of the four of us.
But, yeah.
We all played golf, we all played hockey, and I started to get a lot better in high school, and I realized that, you know, being good at high school golf in California is kind of like being good at high school hockey in Canada.
Yeah.
Like California is a golf state, not a hockey state. So I didn't play, I never played more golf than hockey until I went to college. Coach Ray said, if you get into school, I'll have a spot for you on the team. And I didn't take a day off from when I started my spring season in high school of my senior year all the way until the following winter break. So it was like almost a year and a half. I played golf every day, and I was just super excited, loved it, not burn out. And I think I think hockey players and tennis players, like the movement translates well to golf. Baseball doesn't. Because you're spinning your hips out, coming over the top, and
exactly.
I was lucky that, you know, it trained a lot of the right motor patterns. I still skate every once in a while. I think it's a great workout, but I was pretty raw going into college, pretty unrefined as a golfer.
Well, I'm glad that you just talked about some of the motor patterns that hockey teaches you in golf, because I noticed this when we pulled some video this is from Golf Digest, and we actually had it for the broadcast at the RSM of you like shooting some slap shots. And I initially watched it and I was like, holy crap, dude, the ground force reaction thing that all these golf nerd teachers talk about. He does it in this like hockey slap shot. His left foot goes forward and his right foot is like pushing off the ground laterally. And that's like, when you look at, I know Scottie Scheffler's falling all over the place, but when you look at what he does with his feet, that's the type of like pattern that he's creating in his downswing. And you do it with slap shot.
So like, it's funny you say that, because 3 weeks ago I was, you know, Scott and I were just talking about, you know, this kind of come over the top and smack down on it and get your hips moving out of the way and rotating. And Scott's like, that's a slap shot. So we went out to City National Arena where the Golden Knights practice here in Vegas, and did a stick and puck and shot around, and Scout actually filmed face on and down the line of a slap shot. And we sent it to Scotty Ham, and he's like, yep, that's a cut shot. So,
right.
But the other things too, like when you're skating, you're on knives. So you've got to always maintain your balance on the inside of those edges. Otherwise you're going to fall over. And when you're turning, like skating in a circle, the centrifugal force is trying to push you over outside. So you got to have a lot of core strength and oblique strength to stay upright. And then you add the rotational component in there. And then when I went and skated and shot pucks, the thing that was the most sore were my hands and forearms. Cause if you watch when I'm shooting, you push down on the ice, and that's what kicks the stick forward and shoots the puck. So, it's just a lot of forearm and hand strength. And, I actually booked a couple ice sessions this week. I'm going to go there and do my off-season training, my speed training.
What do you mean your speed training? So what does that mean? Like
I just shoot pucks. It makes me faster.
Like hitting a golf ball, it makes you faster.
Like I bet if I go skate for 3-4 hours over the course of this week, I'll be 2 to 3 miles an hour faster.
What? And totally. you just feel it almost at the bottom with just how you're pushing off the ground at the correct time. And that just itself is just, creating just a little bit more power. Maybe your core is just a little bit more activated, just some muscles that maybe get neglected.
I just think it's hard to train the way your body moves in a gym. Cause like weights and stuff are generally very one dimensional. And like, unless you're spending on $20,000 movement machines, like it's really hard to replicate that. Plus it's really fun, and getting all the muscle groups to work together, synchronized together. And, I just sore in random places, and,
that's crazy.
It's fun. But like, even too, like shooting pucks, and if your hands and your forearms are getting really strong, chopping out of the rough at Torrey or,
I'm pretty good at that at Torrey.
Yeah. I feel like it. Yeah.
But wait, will you ever take the golf clubs and hit balls like on the ice and maybe put the ball on the mat to like try to create some strength doing that? Like, can you hit into a net with that? Is that possible? I don't know how slick ice is to do that. Or is that too much? Yeah.
I think the benefit is just shooting pucks. Cause like, I don't want to train anything that's close to a golf swing, but not quite. Cause I feel like that'll build bad habits. But, shooting a puck is different enough, but still like fires the same muscle groups in the same way. So I'm like, I kind of want to just buy like a slide board and put it in the garage and just fire pucks in the garage.
Dude, you sneaky have a lot of speed with the hockey stick. Like that puck was coming off. I was like, that's not a lollygagged slap shot. That's like knuckle puck slap shot from Mighty Ducks. Like that's the guy they bring in at the end of the game, the knuckle puck time, because it's coming off with some heat, man.
Yeah. It's not my proudest moment, but I did break a kid's foot by shooting a puck off the inside of his skate. I mean, there's a soft spot on the skate there, but I still feel really bad about it, but.
Shouldn't have been skating there, Maverick. He just needs to get out of the way.
The worst part of hockey is blocking shots. Not even close. Like, I would much rather take a hit than block a shot, but you got to do both. But it's weird. Like, I like it. It's a workout. It's not. And I feel like the other thing too that's beneficial about skating is your hips become really strong and really mobile in every direction. Mm. And I've never had back problems, and I think a lot of that's due to my hips being able to move properly without me even trying.
Wow.
I think your hips lock up, the first thing that goes is your lower back, so that to me has been really valuable.
I got dad back over here. You're preaching to the choir as I'm sitting in chairs more often than I ever have. I'm answering emails, these sorts of things, and of course, the deadlift, lifting a baby out of the crib when you haven't stretched in the morning properly. So these are all things that us dads are dealing with on a daily basis. And I'm from Alabama, so we don't got no ice rinks around here, Maverick. No. So I'm just going to have to make do with what we got. All right. So there was one quick note on the overall balance of work ethic that I wanted to ask about, how your dad, when he was going to read all these books or papers or doing these emails and we talk about, you know, how hard a professional golfer, you know, how much work it really takes to do all that. So what is something that you learned from your dad as he, you know, worked his tail off, but also was able to be a father in this? Is there something that maybe one day, if you're ever going to be a father, that maybe you could pass along as someone that, you know, ran a pretty big company and was very successful in business? Is there anything that he brought home that was really good as far as him parenting and then also still running his business?
Well, I think the reason my brothers and I are all well behaved is because we're just scared of our mom. She's the sweetest lady in the world, but she don't want to
keeps cross order. Yeah,
absolutely. A lot of what I learned from dad are I learned by his example, like just the way he worked. I mean, he never goes anything less than 100% at anything. Worked really, really hard. Was fortunate to have the ability to kind of scale that back a bit when we were growing up. And he just, you know, he realized that he would rather have someone else run the company and take us to the driving range in the morning and do stuff like that and be a hockey coach and caddy at the US Open. And,
which I enjoyed, you know, having him. It was fun to watch.
Yeah. I didn't really realize what he was in the tech industry growing up because I was 10, 11 when he essentially stepped down. And I didn't really realize that. And I think it's pretty cool discovering mm-hmm. that. Like I found a business card randomly in a drawer at home. It was like the Sun Microsystems Qualities of a Leader. And it was like a 10 or an 11 step thing. I was like, that's really cool. I'm going to save that. And, you know, use that when I'm trying to lead and manage my team, in the golf. So that was really cool, but I'm just fortunate that he really put us first. Like he never missed a hockey game. He never missed a golf tournament. And, that's really special. And
yeah,
someday I'll be a dad and, you know, I want to strike that balance between showing them how hard I work, but also be present for them and what they want. And, you know, the balance, there's a balance to everything. Let them
for sure
try stuff and figure out what works for them and make their own mistakes, but also kind of guide them along the right way. One of the coolest things though, I think from growing up with my dad as my father is the people he knew and just the people we had at our dinner table. He intentionally did this where he would invite, cool, interesting people over for dinner and then grill them on like how they got to where they were, how did they, succeed in life? What's their life story? You know, what life lessons have they learned along the way? What could they pass along to us? What do they wish they did differently? Stuff like that. And
has your dad ever thought about starting a podcast?
Oh, I mean, it wouldn't be a very PC podcast, but,
yeah. Well, I mean, all those things I'd be interested in listening to.
Yeah, it is fascinating. That guy knows a lot. And, it's just random situations like voice pops up in my head and I kind of know what my dad would say.
Yeah. So. Well, I know that Charlie and I, we would potentially like to put our chips forward for Maverick McNealy. We'd like to formally recommend you as the new CEO of the PGA Tour. I don't know if you saw that the PGA Tour and Jay Monahan is offering a CEO position, recently, if I guess this is for PGA Tour Enterprises, I guess is what I assume the CEO role is for. And Charlie and I would like to formally nominate and recommend you to the seat. Do you accept? Or are we going to maybe push that down the line a bit?
I appreciate that. I mean, I've seen some of the pay packages that have come forth lately. It sounds like a pretty good job. But no, I'm a golfer first. You know, I could probably help you more, or maybe not you, but help people more with their putting and chipping than
me and
you running
both
a multi-billion-dollar business. I'm not an MBA, but you know, it's interesting what's been going on with the tour. I'm on the pack. The pack mm-hmm. doesn't really make decisions. We just kind of say what we think about what the tour is doing and gonna do.
Well, you made the best suggestion, I think, because you and I both, I at least this time last year, I'm looking at the distribution points list for what would be the season with open events, signature mm-hmm. events, and majors. And I'm sitting here looking at it, and I'm thinking, how in the world does anybody have a chance outside mm-hmm. of the signature events? And I'm sitting yeah. here looking at it, I'm running the numbers, and I called Charlie, and I'm like, buddy, nobody's got a chance. The numbers that they're spinning out saying that, you know, 35% retention rate, like that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Like there's no chance that's going to happen.
After Memphis, I went into Memphis 59th in the FedEx Cup and 6th in strokes gained for the year.
and you're not the only guy. Yeah. Davis Thompson was another player that was very high in strokes gain. Keith Mitchell was another yep. player that was really mm-hmm. high in strokes gain. And everybody's looking at your season. You're like, oh, you know, they had pretty good seasons. And, you know, they're just not quite over the hump yet. It's like, actually, no, they played really good with the system yeah. that was in place.
Yeah, I totally agree. I got to give a lot of credit to guys like Lonto Griffin and Nate Lashley, who were trying to do something about it to start the year, but there wasn't really any traction. One, people laughed at them because they're like, you know, that's how many wins do they have? Just kind of the snarky comments that mm-hmm. happen when you're not a top player and you kind of stick your neck out there. But, happy for Lonto that he got back on.
That was awesome to see.
That was cool. But they were totally right. And it took about half a year's worth of data. I was on a flight actually to Cartersville to see pro. And, I was like, I feel like this isn't fair. I'm going to find out. And about 2 hours later, I was like, yeah, this is totally not correct. And, I sent it to pro. I sent it to Hunter. He does my stats. And, you know, like Hunter 2 months later, Hunter Stewart. Yeah. Yeah. It felt like half, if not more of the tour had seen it because everyone was noticing it. We just didn't really have the number to put our finger on it. And I'll give the tour credit for getting it right immediately after and starting right. this next season. But it was definitely a ready, fire, aim type of situation.
Did you come up with any of the data points? Because what I read was that Corey Connors was the example that you mm-hmm. gave, and it was his mm-hmm. sixth place at the Canadian Open. And I believe it was the 21st at the Memorial. Correct me if I'm wrong. 28th at the Memorial, y'all. This mm-hmm. is a signature event mm-hmm. with only 70 guys playing. So basically 28th, you know, this is some redneck math. That's like barely beating 60% of the field. And you're yeah. getting the same amount of points for finishing sixth place at the Canadian Open, which I assume probably had a field of 156.
Yep. Yeah. Granted, you know, it's not the same caliber top to bottom, but Datagolf does a really good job. OWGR does a really good job of, you know, standardizing the strength of field. And, right. And so that's kind of what you want the same level of play, no matter whether you're playing in Punta Cana or Houston or the Masters,
like right.
you want the same level of play to be rewarded the same number of points. Purse is a different story. Like, got to reward those guys that had a great year and are going to play those signatures events. That's a great reward, a great way to kind of guarantee a field is if you're paying $20 million. But points,
needs to be fair, right?
You start on January 1st, like everyone needs the same chance to win the FedEx Cup.
What do you feel about these new policy changes as far as, you know, limiting from 125 to 100? You know, DP World Tour went from 10 cards to 10 cards. Corn Ferry Tour went from 30 to 20. It seems to me that it's just getting tougher and tougher and tougher to keep your card on the PGA Tour. Now, you did help the PGA Tour and making it more fair from a point standpoint to where, mm-hmm. you know, you do have a chance and there are opportunities to get into signature events. It's not like you're shut out. There's still, mm-hmm. you can still play your way into it, but still, what's your opinion on the changes and maybe where signature events currently stand, which is, you know, still 70 dudes or so playing.
Yeah. This is completely my opinion, probably not a popular opinion among the management of the tour, but, guys are coming saying, why are we going from 125 to 100? Why are we shrinking the membership? And backing up a little bit, the problem we have is we have 240 to 260 exempt members, and mm-hmm. we're trying to cram those into 156 player fields, a lot, most of which don't finish for daylight. If we have any sort of weather delay, we're finishing round two halfway through Saturday and cramming a bunch of golf in Sunday. And it's just, you know, it's,
you know, I don't like, I don't like the excuse for too many guys and any weather thing. I feel like that using slow play and potential for weather. And I go, and you go ask any PGA Tour player, they're just like, give me a tee time. I don't care about, I could finish on Saturday morning. I don't care, but I don't like that as the number one excuse.
I agree with that. I think at least where I come on it, my opinion is that if 120 players in the field is actually going to be better for the tour as a whole than 156, that's understandable. I get it. If that's the case, then you definitely have to strengthen the Korn Ferry Tour. But where I cannot defend 120 is if you are only letting 72 players in these signature events. That's 400 playing opportunities over the course of the year. You can't tell me that 72 is a better product than 120.
Yeah.
And I can absolutely not defend cutting the membership down to 100 cards if you're still only letting 72 play these signature events. So that's where I stand on it. I hope that the numbers they chose are the best for the tour as a whole, because I think that's the only way you can justify the decision. If it really is a better product, it drives better ratings. If it is better for the fans, better for the players, fine.
It remains to be seen though, because WGC is not, weren't exactly successful. It's pretty much the same model as WGC's.
Yeah. Totally agree. And I just have not heard an argument that has convinced me that 72 is a better product than 120.
120 was always the right amount of guys at a tournament. If
for like a premier tournament.
Yeah. Like if when you showed up at Bay Hill, when you showed up at the Memorial, those events that had 120, it felt like it was exclusive. It felt like the tee times for that extra like 3 or 4 minutes, you notice it as a player because you don't wait quite as much as you would in a 144 or 156. And it still was competitive for a cut.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was telling to me this year at the AT&T when I was staying at my grandparents' house in Carmel, and I saw the front page of the Carmel Pinecone, and it said, despite the changes this year, we still believe that the AT&T Pebble Beach is going to be a success. And I was like, isn't that the opposite of the point? Shouldn't this be like the biggest deal? And the town was quiet. Yeah. Usually you can't get a reservation. Like restaurants were empty. I mean...
I hate losing all the AMs and the celebrities, all the people and the relationships you make from that event. You know, I have so many people from playing at Pebble Beach that I keep up with still today.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. It's my favorite event of the year. Like Pebble's my favorite golf course on tour. And, you know, from a player's perspective, it was really freaking cool to have all the best players playing at Pebble Beach on Saturday and Sunday. Like,
yeah.
Amazing. It felt like a US Open from that regard. But I just use that as an example, not to say that I don't like that tournament because that's my favorite tournament, but I just don't know if the whole pitching 72 players has had the impact that the tour has wanted to. And we haven't gotten a straight answer. So I'm just guessing. They don't show us, you know, what NBC thinks, what the ratings are.
Yeah.
They don't show us any of that, but
this is a big benchmark year for it. I feel like, cause I think if they feel like it's not doing as much and there's enough complaints that they might go to a different model heading in. Cause this just seems like a filler year until we get to 2026 anyways.
I totally agree. I totally agree.
All right, man. Well, we're about at the end of this thing, Maverick, and on the way out, I want you to tell me about on the way out, meaning you've been flying, dude. Like you've been up in the air, operating a airplane. Out of 10, how hard is it? Is it, you know, was it frightening at the beginning? Because you picked all this up during your shoulder injury, correct or no? Mm-hmm.
I did. I started a little bit before, kind of, I call him Uncle George. George McNeil was kind of the inspiration for that.
George McNeil. That's right.
One of the coolest guys to ever play the PGA Tour. But he flew himself around on tour, and from Vegas, the planes that I can fly, they don't go far enough. They don't go fast enough to really travel event to event. But, I will never forget the day I soloed for the first time. And, like, you lift off and you realize you're the only one that can get this plane back on the ground. That was an amazing experience.
Where were you flying to? Were you flying to a tournament or just doing like a solo flight?
No, literally. So your first solo, like you fly with your instructor to an airport. And then you do a couple laps in the pattern. So you take off, you turn around, you come land, taxi back, same thing. And then the instructor's like, all right, you're ready. He hops out of the plane, has a little handheld radio, and you just take off, do the same thing, three laps in the pattern. And, it was really, really cool. Like I went to bed the night before feeling like I had the lead at a major going into Sunday. I was like, but same kind of thing. Like you lock in, you start your routine, like you put the power in, you do all your checklists, and it's just like you execute the next thing, next thing, next thing. And then all of a sudden you're on short file and you land it and do it again. So I actually finally bought a plane.
Did you?
I'm going to be flying to all the West Coast events. I'll probably have an instructor with me for most or all of the legs just to make it not stressful in case we get bad weather and, you know, in case I'm exhausted flying from one to the next. I don't want to, you know, it's definitely mentally taxing.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to mess up and you don't want to be average out there. And
no, you do not.
No. I think the most important piece of safety is just never exceed your limitations. You know your limitations and don't exceed them and you'll be fine.
Sounds like you're turning this hobby into a passion. Seems like
I love it, man. I love it.
Maybe that hobby or a passion could potentially be in the CEO of the PGA Tour. Maybe that's in the eventual cards of Maverick McNealy. We don't know, but we're excited to watch. And I'm excited to watch you on the golf course, hearing about your plane adventures. And of course, congrats to you and your bride. I guess a year later, very exciting for y'all. And again, excited for you guys to go to Century and celebrate a PGA Tour win and hopefully get number two right away.
That's the plan. I want to go back.
Well, send your best to your dad and Merry Christmas to you guys, and appreciate you coming on, man.
Will do. Absolutely.
Thanks, Maverick. Thank
you. You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our lovely fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people of YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the